press record. Welcome to another episode of Listen, Learn, and Love, hosted by Richard Osler. My guest on today's podcast, who's phoning in from Michigan, is my friend Rebecca Moore. Welcome, Rebecca.
Hi, how are you?
And I have a little head cold, our listeners, so I may not sound my normal voice, but really not to hear my voice. We're here to hear Rebecca's voice, so we thought we'd proceed anyway with the podcast. Rebecca and I offered a prayer. We pray that a good spirit will be here. I became aware of Rebecca through Twitter, and there was a tweet specifically on Christmas Eve that we may get to later in this podcast that Rebecca tweeted out. She said, "God is not dead, nor doth she sleep." She being capitalized, and I thought, what a thoughtful tweet about our Heavenly Mother. And it caused me to sort of then look closer at your Twitter feed, Rebecca. And there was a talk you gave about fasting. There's a Twitter thread about Rebecca from the Old Testament. And I just sense you're a wonderful, thoughtful member of our church that I can learn from and our listeners can learn from. So by way of background, Rebecca's in her mid-20s. She's single. She's pursuing a career, which we may get to be part of NASA, which is really cool. Right now she has a public affairs degree from, I believe, BYU Idaho. Is that correct, Rebecca?
Yes, it is correct. I did go to school there.
And both of us are active LDS. Both of us have recently gone to the temple and are aware of the new temple changes and are excited about that. I'm not sure we'll get to that in the podcast, but we both have probably really enjoyed going to the temple in the last couple of days. But anyway, Rebecca, just welcome to the podcast and go ahead, just introduce yourself to our listeners. If they're meeting you for the first time, just give us a little bit of background, even though I've done some.
Well, yeah, my name is Rebecca, as you said. I currently live in Michigan, which is where I grew up. I was born in California, in Redondo Beach, but I grew up here. A lot of my family is from Michigan, and I, however, am only here temporarily, hopefully. As you mentioned, I am currently pursuing a career. The long-term goal is I want to run NASA.
I love that.
My goal is to be the head of NASA.
I hope all our listeners heard that. I want to run NASA. That's awesome.
That is the big long-term goal, but my path to getting there, I've decided on. I decided to join the service. I decided to join the Air Force specifically. And I am, I got accepted as an officer a little while ago, and I got accepted into flight school because I'm hoping to eventually apply for the astronaut program. I am currently going through the process of reapplying because I left for officer training. And while I got there and I was like, oh, yes, this is definitely the place for me to be, I ended up having to leave early because I failed my fitness test, which was heartbreaking to say the least. But I have... I haven't changed in my resolve and my goals, and I was lucky enough to leave with a lot of support and encouragement, and was told that I would have the opportunity to reapply if I wanted to take it. I did, and I was recently told that my request had been approved by the Vice Commandant's office. However, I am still waiting to hear whether or not recruiting has approved my request to go back and start officer training again. And I should hopefully be hearing, I'm actually hoping to hear by tomorrow whether or not I'll be able to, if and when I will be able to go back. So I am quite tenacious, and I have fallen, but will always get back up. So this is me trying at it again.
I love, Rebecca, that you're willing to go back. And even though you failed your fitness test, I understand, barely.
Yes, but one push-up. I missed it.
One push-up. And I love that you're just willing to lean back and go back, and even though there's pain there of it not working out originally, to be able to continue to follow your dreams. I just think that's a sign of great character, the kind of character attributes that, in my experience, leads someone to eventually lead an organization and be able to have their dreams come true. So that's really cool. I think it's a great test of character, how we handle the curveballs as much as anything.
Yeah, it was definitely a curveball. I didn't go there expecting to fail. I thought I was in pretty good shape. But these days I'm in much better shape. I can do many push-ups. So I know that when I go back, I will be nowhere near close to passing. My goal is to actually get 100% on my fitness test if I am fortunate enough to be able to return.
Help our... tell us the background of this talk you gave about fasting, and you can go ahead and give the talk, because as I read through it, I thought this was just a beautiful talk.
Oh, sorry. I gave this talk about 6 months ago, I want to say, maybe a little bit more. I can't remember. It was a number of months ago I gave it in my ward. I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time. Specifically, I was living in Arlington, so I guess right across the river in Virginia. I lived next to the Pentagon. And so I gave this talk in my singles ward. And I can read it now if you'd like.
Yeah, go ahead and read it. I just thought it was great.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay, so it's titled Choosing Your Fast. What is the purpose of denying ourselves two meals every month? Why do we go through the grueling process of putting down the spoonful of freshly poured cereal as we remember, today is the first Sunday. Why is it that we fast? Today, I hope to provide an answer to that question. In this talk, I bring you no stories of fasting curing cancer or instantly providing revelation as to whom you're to marry. I will give you no promises of how you are just perfect enough, whatever that's supposed to mean. Near fasting, that suddenly all of your problems will be solved at work and you'll easily get into the law school of your choice. I promise you no temporal blessings today. Not to say that they may or may not come, simply to start us on the clear understanding that fasting does not find its purpose in what we get from it in the here and now. Fasting finds its purpose not in the temporal, but rather the eternal. It is not what we get from it today that matters, but rather who it helps us become tomorrow. In Isaiah 58, we read, is it such a fast that I have chosen, a day for man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head as a bulrush and to spread a sackcloth and ashes under him? Wilt thou call this a fast, an acceptable day to the Lord? Is this not the fast that I have chosen, to loose the bands of wickedness, to undo heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that ye break every yoke? That is a tall order for a fast. Lifting heavy burdens, breaking every yoke. How is it that skipping two meals is supposed to let the oppressed go free? Perhaps it is not found in the literal fasting, but rather the model that fasting gives us. In the next verse, it tells us what I hope we already know, which is that as we fast, we deal thy bread to the hungry, bring the poor that are cast out to thy house, and when thou seest the naked, that thou cover him. These days, most of us fulfill that by giving a generous fast offering, though of course we are not limited to this, and hopefully we all find other ways to help the poor around us. Is that why? Take care of the poor? In part, yes, but I would put to you today that there is still a larger why to be found. What does this model teach us? How does it help us draw closer to Christ and become more like our heavenly parents? Imagine a garden. It has been left in nature for a while and weeds have grown in. So one day, someone goes out and spends a lot of time and effort pulling out every weed, meticulously yanking every leaf, every root that has moved into the soil. They clear the area of what grew in. But then they leave. They say, my work here is done. No, not even close. Their work has just begun. The purpose of a garden is not to be a patch of dirt absent of weeds. Removing the weed is simply a step in making room for a much more desirable option. The purpose of a garden is to grow something greater. fasting is not to solely be about denying ourselves food. It must then be followed by the giving of that food in some way to those who have less. The absence we have made in our life is to be filled. We have put off the natural man for a period and sought to replace it with a higher law that is outward focused. This is, of course, not to imply that eating is bad, but rather symbolic of the natural man. This model can be applied to just about every aspect of our lives. We should do more than just fast from food. We should fast from sin. But it is not enough to pull out the sin or even just natural but limiting habits. We must plant something that will flourish in our stead. The world, and when I say the world, I include the church as we exist in it, is filled with things that should be fasted from. Greed, violence, the othering of people unlike ourselves, the debasement of so many's humanity have become too commonplace. Now, some have tried to start the weeding process in many of these areas. For example, harassment, assault, and the general mistreatment of women has run rampant for all too long, but it appears that we may have reached a cultural shift. We seem to be finally having the important discussion of what is not acceptable, and I am hopeful that we are beginning to pull at the roots of the debasement of women. But it is not enough. If you are a man looking inward as this shift happens and say, well, I don't assault women, I must be okay. No. What are you planting in that space? Are you looking outward and seeking to uplift? Do you respect women? Do you listen to their voices? Do you try and know them on an individual basis? Do you seek their perspectives? Do you lift their burdens? Do you see them as having inherent value outside of what you get from them? This is, of course, just one example. There are many that could be found using what fasting teaches us. Anything that ails our world must not just be removed, but replaced. Seek the higher law. This begins with ourselves. As much as we may want to cure the world, this process begins within our own hearts and then moves outward. Are you unkind to your neighbor? Fast from that. But also replace it with friendship. Are you jealous of your sibling? Fast from that. But plant admiration in it instead. Find all that pulls you away from Christ and fast from it, but a change of heart must take its place. It is not enough to root out cruelty. We must replace it with compassion. Sometimes we can fall into a trap believing that our righteousness is shown in what we can deny ourselves. How long can we not eat? Perhaps we do fast exactly for 24 hours. And also never see a movie with a higher than G rating and never try a tiramisu and never spend any money on a Sunday and never look at a bear's shoulder until the day you die. It's easy to try and find salvation in the rules. But when a near draconian interpretation leads us to a place where we are too focused on what we cannot do rather than what we are trying to become, we lose sight of the plan of happiness. Salvation is not found in what we can tear down. Salvation is found in what we can build. As Christ said, moreover, when you fast, be not as of the hypocrites of a sad countenance, for they disfigure their faces, that they may appear unto men to fast. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. In the verse before the aforementioned one in Isaiah, the people are reprimanded. Behold, ye fast for strife and debate. The footnote makes a note saying that fasting without spiritual motivation, all that that engenders is discomfort and irritability. We are taught that men are that they might have joy. So know that you will find no salvation purely in denial. Salvation comes when you let godly joy bloom in your life and seek to give that joy to those around you. It's not just about the growth that will happen in your life, but the opportunity you then have to turn outwards. We are told to break every yoke, not just those that weigh us down. Every burden must be lifted. The spirit of fasting is not, in fact, about deprivation. It is a lesson in growth. It is the promise that what we sacrifice can be replaced with something much greater. It is the promise that humanity has the ability to put off the natural man that cares only for itself and let empathy, understanding, generosity, and charity grow in its stead. Choose this fast. Everything in this life is a choice. That's the beauty of it. Next week, as Fast Sunday approaches, we can grumble about how hungry we are, counting the seconds until we can eat dinner. We can choose to afflict our souls, or we can choose another fast. We can do as Isaiah commanded. We We can live a higher law and obtain a higher blessing, and that is becoming more like Christ. The why is found there. We fast from food, from strife, from sin, that we may become more like our Redeemer, the one who truly did lift every burden and break every yoke. That is a much more important miracle, and it is the only one that I will promise you today. I promise that it is indeed possible to become like Christ. As impossible as that may feel some days, it is within reach. But remember, Christ is the living God, so let life bloom. And that's the end of my talk.
I really love that talk, Rebecca. Is it weird to give a talk a second time in a podcast?
No, not too much. I spend enough time either writing, or I've actually been on another podcast before. It's not too weird. I probably am more at home on the internet, almost.
I think one of the things that talk resonated with me is we talk a lot about the covenant path in our church, which I believe in and support. And I think sometimes I think of that as just me sort of isolating myself into perfection and doing all these things I need to do, including fasting. But I like the way you took the doctrine of fasting and then talked about our role then through fasting to be able to then help other people. Because I think the covenant path, I sometimes paint this line that goes upward, which is a line from the ground to the ceiling, which is our relationship with God and commandment keeping. But then I think the other part of the covenant path is a line that goes sideways, and that's our relationship and responsibility with other people. And I've never heard a fasting talk that kind of talked about going sideways the way you did and becoming more Christ-like by understanding and empathizing and helping other people. So that's one of the things I really loved about your talk.
Thank you. I over the past few years, I've been really grappling with why I do what I do and why I believe what I believe, and working on making sure that what I do and what I believe has purpose and is not something that I do just because I was told. One of the joys of Mormon theology for me.
Rebecca?
One of the great joys I've always found in Mormon theology is the emphasis that we have placed on free will and how central that is, and how that is, in fact, the most important thing. And so I want to make sure as I look inward to my motivations of why I'm doing things, that I'm not just doing or believing something because I was told to. And at the end of the day, I find that it is best if I am. Christ talks about the two great commandments being to love God and to love your neighbor. And as I have tried to make sure that I am living up to those two things, that I am living a life where I am outward focused in everything that I do and prioritizing helping other people, that I am able to live that kind of a life where I love my neighbor and I love God. And I think it's through those things that I've been able to understand the why why I believe certain things that I believe, because at the end of the day, helping other people is the most important thing. And so I wanted to make sure that I was incorporating that, because I genuinely don't believe there is any part of the gospel that cannot be both inwardly and outwardly focused. There is nothing that is something that will only help us. We can always and should help ourselves, but we can always make sure that we are not becoming too self-centered and only concerned with our own salvation.
I really like that. I keep kind of reminding myself I'm talking to someone in their mid-20s, because your perspective and maturity in life is a lot different and more mature than I was at your age. And it's one of the reasons I am so high on our millennial members, because of your worldview and the way that then the gospel fits with that, and some of the things that you're doing at your age that I wasn't able to sort of do at my age. And I think it's a maturing of our gospel, and I think it's the sign we have more thoughtful and mature members. And I've certainly learned in my YSA assignment to listen to the women in my ward, people like you, for what I could learn from them. And that's really thoughtful. Tell us about Rebecca. You were tweeting about Rebecca, and my wife and I have a daughter that is probably a little bit like you. She loves examples of wonderful women in our scriptures. And
yes.
Tell us about Rebecca.
Yeah. Just to be clear, he's not asking about, tell us about me. Yes. I'm going to tell you about Rebecca in the Old Testament. So something to know about me is I'm a little bit like Hermione from Harry Potter. I have always been very studious, and that extends not just for my academic study, but it extends into gospel-related things. So I can talk a lot about a lot of more, I don't know, maybe academic perspective of things, but I've been working on trying to shift it to the more applicable. And one of the people that I have always enjoyed studying is Rebecca in the Old Testament. She is the one that married Isaac. She often gets confused for Rachel, because Rebecca and Rachel sound similar. But yeah, she is the one that got married to Isaac. And so what I wrote recently that you saw, and I've also given several lessons in either Sunday school or at least study about this. Rebecca is a really good lesson in making sure you are listening to your own internal moral compass. You are listening to what you know is right in spite of others around you maybe telling you that something is wrong. And this kind of goes back to what I had mentioned earlier, because I think she's a great example of a person who I would want to live more like. And that I was mentioning, I frequently try and look at commandments and ask myself, okay, am I doing this because I was told to do this, or am I doing this because I think there's actual value here? And Rebecca has two notable episodes that are recorded about her life. And both of the episodes are her ignoring the men around her and doing what she thought was right, in spite of either cultural or even perhaps a prophetic, quote unquote, take. She was first introduced into the scriptures when she was to leave to go and marry Isaac. She had met Abraham's servant at the well, and she had demonstrated quite the act of charity by watering all of his camels, which is a very arduous task, definitely. And he took this to be a sign that she would be a good wife. And so he went to go ask her brother Laban, who is probably one of my least favorite people in scripture. he went to go ask her brother Laban if she could come with him, and Laban said no. Tradition dictated at the time that she should stay, and also, I mean, as we've, Laban reappears within the Old Testament narrative, and he can just be a stickler for things sometimes. So, but as her older brother, he did have, he could tell her what to do, but she said no, and she left with Isaac's servant because she felt that that was the right thing. She said, "I will go and do." I don't think she said it. I think she just said, "I will go." Not that I'm saying that. wrong person. But so she left despite her brother's wishes. And as she gets older, she once again ignores both tradition and at this point, even more significantly, the guidance of her husband, who was a prophet at the time. Isaac wanted to follow the traditions of the day and give the birthright to Esau, the elder of his two children, and Esau was also his favorite. However, Rebecca had been given revelation prior, many years prior, when she was pregnant, that Esau was not supposed to have the birthright, that it was supposed to, in fact, go to Jacob. But this is not what her husband, the prophet, wanted, but she knew, regardless, she knew what was right, and she trusted her own experiences. And we see the story of her making sure she actually tricked her husband into giving Jacob the birthright, because she knew that that was what it was supposed to be. And both of those accounts of her both show a woman who is concerned with doing the right thing, not the appropriate thing. And because society or tradition dictates one thing, or even necessarily the spiritual traditions of her day would certainly have said that anyone, not just her, should have listened to Isaac. He was the, you know, he was the one at the time. But she didn't discount what had happened to her. And she prioritized those experiences. And I think that can be really hard and isolating. And I know I've spent a lot of my time in the church, both as one of these people and talking with other people who grapple with feelings that this way that we do things is not right. And I know it's not right. And how do I go about changing that? And how do I go about advocating for change? And I always hope that I will have enough courage to be more like her and be willing to do the right thing in spite of the people around me who I've been told are the ones that know what the right thing is. I hope that I don't ever abandon my own free will and agency, because it would be easier or more convenient to follow traditions and just say, well, that's how things are done, and I guess I'll get an answer later and things will be fixed. Somebody else will do it. She did it herself, and she was an actor, and she wasn't acted upon. And I think there is something deeply profound to that. It's profound to me that she didn't question. She didn't say, well, Isaac probably knows what he's talking about. He's my husband. He's the prophet. He's probably right. But she knew what she knew, and she stuck to her gut. And I find that to be an example that I want to live up to.
I love that story. I guess I'm thinking out loud here that Isaac's the prophet, so he would be the prophet for the nation, you know, his stewardship responsibility. So Rebecca, I'm not sure, I don't think you said this, she'd be the prophet in the sense she would have God's call for the nation, but she is an equal companion to Isaac in their marriage about the birthright of their children, and she would be entitled to receive equal personal revelation for that decision within their family. Is that comfortable to you, what I just said, or would that be uncomfortable?
Yeah. I mean, I would agree. I think that is how the story goes, that she is the one that received the revelation. It wasn't Isaac. She had that right. It's interesting to read that story to wonder why. Sometimes it's very possible that Isaac was perhaps not receptive to that idea, to the idea of bucking conventional norms, because of the combination of he just thought that this is the way that things go and the oldest gets the birthright. And also the scriptures tell us that Esau was his favorite. So the combination of those things may have led to him perhaps not being as receptive, which is why I don't know why it was only Rebecca that received the revelation. But it is at the end of the day. And I do believe she had a right to that.
So. I do too. And I look at, I think of this story and I want to scale it. Like I'm thinking back in ward council, where we would meet as a ward council when I served. And I think in that situation, all of us had equal personal revelation for the needs of our ward members. And I used to always think, you know, the Relief Society president, when we were talking about the men, I'd always want the Relief Society president's opinion. And sometimes with the elders' quorum president about the women, because I've always felt that everybody in that room may have a perspective, or God may be have a way for God to talk in that council about everybody that needed to be served and every answer and every question we were wrestling with. So I think one of the things that you're teaching us with the story is Rebecca is that isn't just me, since I was the bishop, that had revelation for everybody in the ward, but in that ward council setting, everybody potentially had insights that were valuable as we work together to understand an individual situation or a ward goal. I think of that in my marriage with my wife, that I'm hopefully an equal companion and recognizing at times she will have insights that I won't have, and I need to, and even if I'm the bishop of the ward, that doesn't mean that I have more insights like Isaac would into his family. So I love some of the things you're sharing there. Does that all seem okay with you?
Yeah, I definitely appreciate the idea of making sure that everybody has an equal opportunity to voice their perspective. I think that's one of the joys of ward council, is to have the opportunity to hear from more than one person. And I hope as the church grows, they are able to move into a place where they're helping the concept of ward council to live up to its best potential, which would mean you have as many different voices as possible in that room.
Yeah. One of the trainings I received was, since I was the bishop, is be careful, because once you state an opinion, you're going to shut down the rest of the discussion. You sort of staked a flag. So I had to discipline myself to not to just really be teachable and really be open to the spirit and to the input of the women and men in our ward council. Because I recognize that if I sort of said this is the way it's going to be, it's hard for people. I'm just going to read a tweet here as part of your Rebecca story.
Okay.
Guys, your name is spelled R-E-B-E-C-C-A, and Rebecca.
Yes. I have the English spelling, not the Hebrew.
And so, yeah, that's right. There you go. It's the Hebrew sparing. But I love this. The point of Rebecca's story is that you're entitled to your own revelations and your own decisions. You don't need to look to men for either of these, either of them. You know what's right. Trust your gut. Trust your internal compass. Men's morality isn't superior to yours. I really love that tweet. Maybe 5 years ago, I would have thought, well, it seems a little edgy to me, but I don't think that's, I don't think that's edgy. I think it is the doctrine of our church and the doctrine of Christ and the way personal revelation works. Do you want to expound any more on that tweet?
It's funny. I feel like my Twitter is such a mess of like terribly jumbled thoughts and then occasionally
same.
Good things.
I think your Twitter
probably
is
one
good.
Of the, it's probably one of the better thoughts that I've written. I don't think I will put forward any sort of front, nor have I in a long time, but existing in the church has always been something that's easy for me. There are a lot of traditions, culturalisms, even things that some people might consider doctrine that don't sit well with me. And I have spent my entire life grappling with, is this something that I need to change within myself? Is this something that I need to work on? Or is this something that I need to be externally focused on? In other words, it's something that I do know is wrong and I should be advocating for change. And because the thing is, as I mentioned earlier, I do believe in the concept that free will is the most important thing. So when people say, well, if it's important, God will fix it. No, I do not believe that in the slightest. If we're expected to fix things, it's our responsibility. And I am not going to pass that off on to anybody else. And I believe that I have been given a moral framework, and I believe that I have the ability to ask, and I've taught this as a youth, and I still believe that I have the ability to ask and find things out on my own. And I think it's important that sometimes we stand up and say, I don't think this is right. I don't think the fact that we're doing this is right. I think this is something we should work on changing. And I have been incredibly fortunate in my time. I know I'm not unique in this. There are plenty of other people who have spent their life advocating for changes in the church. I have had the good fortune of not running into too many leaders who felt the need to who felt the appropriate reaction was discipline for my perhaps unconventional thinking on things, and have had a willingness to listen. I know not all people have been fortunate enough to have that. But I want to make sure that I am not doing something just because I was told to do something, because that feels like abandoning my agency. And as I said it, in that tweet, the point of that story is you are entitled to your own revelations and your own decisions. And I can't in good conscience do something just because I was told. That's not a good enough answer for me. Because at the end of the day, that feels like abandoning, like I said, it feels like abandoning my free will, and that is not something I can abide by. So I tend to be very difficult in many spaces and very challenging of a lot of things and critical. I was a very difficult child in Sunday school. but I don't ever want to be a contrarian to be a contrarian. I just want to make sure, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that I am helping as many people as possible, because that I'm advocating for a better church, not so it's a more comfortable place, so everything is according to how Rebecca likes it. And I refer to Rebecca as myself, not Old Testament Rebecca. It's not so everything is the way that I like it. It is, I just want to advocate for a church and a world in general that more people feel supported, safe, that I do as much as I can to help other people as I possibly could. And that includes advocating for a better church and organization that I exist in.
So I'm really comfortable with that. A couple thoughts. One is, I'm thinking you're giving me reflections back on when I served in my YSA assignment as a YSA bishop, and a lot of the YSAs would sometimes come to me and expect me to sort of have the answer for their situation. And I remember when I was in a bishopric, that bishop trained me, and I think he helped me to realize that I probably shouldn't be giving many people answers. I found that I would give them foundational principles to help them make their own decision, but it's like what you're teaching with Rebecca's story is, you know what's right, trust your gut. Don't just because, the bishop is there, I don't think, and so I'm always a little uncomfortable when I hear someone talk about a priesthood leader that said, go to dental school or take this job or marry that person. And I think some of that happens and some of that really can be the way God works. But I think in general, I think priesthood leaders and men, and maybe all of us that don't have, I mean, for my younger kids, I think I sort of can, my wife and I can jointly make decisions for them until they're at the age of maturity. But I think we have to, make sure we're not making decisions for people, and people are owning their own personal revelation.
Yes, I definitely agree. I think that goes back to, as people of the LDS faith, I'm trying to not say Mormons as much anymore. We do believe that the purpose of this life is to grow, and the purpose of all eternity is to grow and learn and progress and change and become something better. Not just if you do X amount of good things, then you get to go to heaven. That's not really what we ascribe to. And I think if we're not encouraging people to think for themselves, to act for themselves, and to make their own decisions and to be critically thinking people, we're not teaching them how to grow. One of my favorite shows on TV right now is The Good Place. I feel a profound connection to that show. As somebody who likes to sit around and grapple with ethics all the time, I love that show. But there is, and I guess this is a slight spoiler, but there's an episode in the third season where they meet somebody who has become very good at following the rules of how to get into the good place. They don't, in the show, they don't call heaven heaven. They call it the good place. And they meet this man who's become very perfect at following all the rules, because the way that the system works in the show is if you get enough points, you get to go to the good place. And this guy has figured it all out, and he's so very good at following rules, and he hasn't grown in years. He hasn't changed as a person. He hasn't learned anything. He hasn't evolved. All he's done is become very good at following rules. And he hasn't thought. He hasn't grown and changed and made mistakes and had to get back up and gone through the messiness that is life. And we have these other characters that exist in this show, which are just, some of them are just truly disasters of people. But they're changing because they're trying. They're not good at following the rules, but they're trying to be better people. And so they're growing and they're learning how to make decisions on their own. And one of the phrases that the show uses that I love is, you can't do something for moral desert. And that's something that they're trying to teach each of these people, each of our main characters, because there's four of them. They're trying to teach them, you have to be a good person just to be a good person. Not because you get a certain amount of points, not because you get a certain amount of reward. You just have to be good, and that's the end of it. And that is really hard, I think. I think it's much easier to want to set up rules and then say, I'm a good person because I followed the rules. But I grew up in a world of, and when I say world, I mean personally, a lot of my family wasn't particularly religious, including my father. And they were some of the best people I knew. And I knew a lot of very religious people. And I believe that all people have the potential for good, some of those people were truly unkind and lacked compassion, but they were very good at following rules. And so I think we need to make sure that we are, this all goes back to what I kept saying at the beginning. Are we helping people? Are we being empathetic? Are we being compassionate?
And that cues me back and, to your fast day talk.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Oh, yeah. About, sorry.
I like that because it comes full circle to your fast day talk. Now, before Rebecca and I came live, I caught up with Rebecca. I've never met Rebecca. She's calling in from Michigan, and we've just known each other on Twitter, but I assumed you were straight, and then you told me in the introduction you're actually bi, and I look back at your Twitter profile and it does say you're bi. So we have lots of LGBTQ guests on this podcast, and so I probably started this podcast thinking we won't get into that space, but you're out as bi. Mm-hmm. And you've kind of talked about how you're probably in a pretty good emotional state. You felt little shame about being bi. You felt not some of the difficult roads that some of our LGBTQ members have felt. And also this feeling, because you're probably in a good spot, is you feel impressed to educate people about LGBTQ. So tell us just a little bit more about your journey. We've got about 10 minutes left in the podcast. Anything you'd like to tell about your own personal journey or on an education standpoint, what you're hoping members to, or our society at large, to learn about our LGBTQ friends?
I would love to do that. I'm a many-layered person, so it probably was not overly apparent from my Twitter because it's not necessarily
I like that you're multi-layered. I think that's really cool, Rebecca.
Thanks. I tend to talk about space mostly. That's the first thing that people notice.
I mean,
the first thing on top
guess.
Of my what thing is a link to NASA. I love space and science and planets. But yes, I did. I came out when, right after I left BYU Idaho, I had started kind of privately coming out while I was there. And I felt really strongly that I had the opportunity to talk to people on a more relatable level, because even though I have often been very difficult, and I use that word within church spaces, this doesn't really come across as a podcast. I can be intimidating as a person. I am 6 feet tall. I am not petite as a person. I am very broad shouldered, kind of pretty muscular these days because of my decision to join the military. But also I just generally carry myself with a larger air, and that has often led to people not bothering me. I did not experience bullying as a child. I just am imposing sometimes, and I work. I'm much like my father in that way. If anybody has ever met my father, he's this just giant of a man, and I look exactly like him except as a woman. And
that's awesome.
I don't think that's the only way. I have just always experienced life with a little bit easier. There's a lot of things that have come to exist that just coincided that I didn't have as rough a time as a lot of other people. And so I just found myself having a little bit more energy and a lot less fear. I know a lot of people are afraid to within both church circles within our own church and other just conservative religious circles, which I also grew up in. The area that I live in is very, very Christian, conservatively. And I heard plenty of homophobia growing up. I kind of let it bounce off of me and be like, well, that's a bad opinion and I will ignore it. But I realized that not everybody has always been able to have that. So as a person who generally has not had to experience a lot of people challenging me or bullying me, and for some reason that I still have not quite been able to nail down, have a willingness to listen to what I have to say, I wanted to make sure that what I was saying was worth something. So I found it easier to say to my priesthood leaders, well, actually, I like women, and there's nothing wrong with that, and I'm not less of a person because of that. I it's not a sinful behavior that I am existing in, and and I've been very lucky to have had people who were willing to listen to me. My last couple bishops, actually, one of them, he actively sought me out, and he just said, I just don't know anything about this. I don't know anything about how to deal with this, and I need to be better at it. He said, this is part of my stewardship, and I don't understand anything. So will you just sit here and let me ask you questions that might be really stupid? But that's I need to cool. ask somebody. And that's I really said, cool. yes, I'm more than happy to do that. I think, like I said, I have been very, very lucky in my life of not necessarily either not having to deal with levels of homophobia that other people have had to deal with, or just a strange ability to let things roll off my back. I don't know if you've ever read that Max Licato book that you are special, but that little puppet that like none of the stickers stick to her. Stickers don't stick to me very easily, whether they be stars or dots. I mean, I'm not perfect about it. They stick every now and again, but in general, I'm like, I'm not overly concerned with what other people think of me, and I'm just going to try and do the right thing here. So something that I would hope that, that as I try and educate people, especially within more traditional religious spaces, is that it's not a bad, there's nothing scary about LGBT people. And hi, I'm one right here, and you're talking to me just fine. And it's not a big deal that I like men and women. And it's not a big deal that, that there's other people who also feel like that. And it's okay. Things are fluid, and people aren't flawed because of that. That's not.
I love that.
That above all else is something that I try and explain to people is, even I think some people who come at it with good intention, with a good heart, and I try and give them grace, but they're like, it's okay. God loves you in spite of your failing as this person with your, and I'm like, no, it's not an in spite of, it's not conditional. This isn't a flaw. This isn't a bug. This is just part of who I am. And part of the reason why it's not the only thing I talk about, and maybe it was not necessarily super apparent as you first scrolled through my online presence, is because I think it's really important to see queer people as multi-layered. They are not solely their sexual identity. Straight people are not solely their sexual identity. Nobody is. And
I love that. I think that's great.
Yeah. It's who you love and who you are attracted to is not a flaw in who you are. It's just something that makes up a part of who you are as a human being. And so I hope to help educate that. And if I am not successful there, which I feel like I have been, but I also have been pretty vocally out for a while because of the fact that I don't dislike myself and I don't carry around feelings of shame. And I have had so many people privately who have been too afraid to come out, too afraid to come to grips with the fact that they are not the same and they are not what they're told they should be, come and find me and say, you're not miserable with yourself. You don't hate the way you are. You're happy. And I had a friend before I left DC who still hasn't come out yet, but they just said, you gave me a light at the end of the tunnel that maybe one day I can just be a little bit more at peace with who I am as a person. So I don't know if I'll ever be completely successful in changing things, but I do hope at least to provide a space where other people who do feel different can come and talk and be a person that they would feel safe with.
I love that, Rebecca. I love, you know, that there's no shame in orientation. That my feeling is God's created everybody as they are intended to be, and there shouldn't be any shame in anybody's sexual orientation. And some would say if either of us say that, well, that sort of opens the door more to potentially people leaving the circle of the doctrine of our church. But I don't think so. I just think it helps those that are LGBTQ not feel shame. And I think then they actually make more thoughtful decisions because they're making decisions from a position of strength. I've always invited our kids, my wife and I, and the YSAs to, when they're making key decisions, try to make it as you are your best emotional and spiritual self and on the best foundation. And I think if you can God, I don't think anybody wants anybody to feel shame for anything. It doesn't, you know, I think guilt can be okay if someone's made a mistake because that can motivate us to improve. But shame is just a something that I think is just a tool of Satan, so to speak, to make us not feel worthy of who we are, or God's love, or full members of society. So I love you have this level of confidence and maturity about you that I think I've been drawn to on your Twitter feed, and I think our listeners are drawn to. And I think you give us hope for the future. I do love that you're willing to sort of see stuff at times that's unsettling to you and say, what can I do in my circle of influence to make a change here? And I think you give a pattern for members. Some members are not unsettled about anything in our church, and some members are. It may be a culture thing, it may be a personal preference of a leader, it may be a policy, it may be even some of our doctrines. And I've learned to try to give people permission to feel how they feel, even if I don't feel that way, because I think then more stay, and we all can work together as a body of Christ. And so I think that's one of the things that I think you're very good at, is saying, you know, I'm here, I'm going to stay, I'm fully engaged in the church and my career and my beautiful life, but I'm also going to try to make a difference at times and maybe share when I'm unsettled about something. We're kind of at the end. Do you have just some concluding thoughts? I want to let our listeners know, if they want to find you on Twitter, you're at the Rebecca Moore.
Yes, I
So
am.
everybody go follow Rebecca Moore
Yeah,
on
unless you're
Twitter.
my parents, then don't go look on Twitter.
And
I say too many things on there.
I
Like I
probably
said, don't. It is a hodgepodge of mess sometimes. You're gonna get something
I know.
profound, but then you're gonna get like a thread of
I was
just
trying to explain
absolute boring
Twitter.
hot takes.
Sometimes I try to explain Twitter to people my age, and it's just this, what sometimes I'm really vulnerable and open and vent, and it's sort of like my journal sometimes, where I'm just,
Yeah.
you know, and but anyway,
I
I
think,
think your Twitter's
well,
great,
I
but
do try and keep a certain level of honesty there,
yes.
because when I had a friend of mine say something really interesting to me when I had to leave officer training. He called me and he, you know, he's very like, oh, I'm so sorry this happened and I'm here, and which was very kind. But he said something. He said, I didn't realize bad things happened to you. I thought, he said, I thought you just existed on a cloud and you didn't have to struggle the way the rest of us mortals do. And I definitely laughed at that, but I realized that, I want to make imperfection, and just not necessarily imperfection, but just an honesty, and messiness sometimes. Sometimes I think to myself, I should be less messy on Twitter, but everybody's messy, and I think it's very easy for a lot of people around me to think that I am not messy, and I want to assure them that I am messy. Everybody's messy, and it's okay that you are, and we can all just be messy together.
That's really cool. That's just so authentic and vulnerable. And when I read Brené Brown, which I wish I'd read a decade ago, and I'm learning how that being vulnerable and transparent and authentic creates genuine connection and community that can help all of us. We all need each other, Rebecca. And so we need communities, and we need to be authentic and real and vulnerable. Any last thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
Let's see. Think for yourself. Don't give your agency to anybody. It is the most important gift that you have. And if I can offer any suggestion on how to best use that, it is you will find joy in serving other people. Like, take care of yourself, definitely. Make sure that you're okay. Make sure your oxygen mask is on. But spend your life in the service of others. Look outward. I believe in community And I believe in making the world a little bit brighter for the people who come after us, and just find optimism in the next day and know that you can get back up after hard things. So have confidence in yourself and have confidence in those other people around you, and don't be afraid. I don't know. I feel like I just said 10,000 cliches, but that's all the advice that I should say very quickly to whoever is listening to this.
I love that, Rebecca, and it's just full of hope. And on behalf of all of our listeners, thank you for joining us, Rebecca Moore. Thanks for your insights. It just gives me hope in the future, and grateful to come across a member like you. I love your dreams. I love that you want to run NASA one day. I want to close my eyes and just, you know, wake up and see where your life is taking you, because I just love that you're vulnerable enough and courageous enough just to say that and to go back to officer school. And I just think, you know, it just gives me hope in the future, and that you're a member of our church and by and have great insights in the new, in the Old Testament, like Rebecca and that fast day talk. And you are multi-layered, and you're, I think all those come together to form a wonderful human with a wonderful, unique life mission. So if you were here, I'd just kind of put my hands on your back and point you forward and say, go for it, Rebecca, because you can do it.
I promise you that I will. I am endlessly tenacious. But and I hope that whoever is listening to this will find that tenacity in themselves.
And thank you for joining us on another episode of Listen, Learn, and Love, hosted by Richard Osler.